With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello everyone, welcome to yet another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivetus, and thank you once again for tuning in. So we've got one of my favorite true crime subjects on the docket today, John Dillinger. Public enemy number one, outlaw, desperado, Depression-era Robin Hood, cold-blooded murderer. There have been lots of opinions over the years on who John Dillinger really was. And I've got one of the world's best experts on the subject, Ellen Poulsen, and my conversation with her was an entertaining marathon once again, so there are two parts to this interview. But a quick word before we begin part one. A grand shout out today to Kim Elliott of Corning, California, one of my brand new NewsHound patrons on Patreon.com. Thank you so much for your wonderful patronage, Kim. And again, a thank you to all of my amazing patrons at patreon.com/mostnotorious. There are, by the way, different tiers for different budgets, but all tiers come with ad-free episodes delivered straight to your phone of not only my Most Notorious podcast, but my Minnesota's Most Notorious podcast as well. Swing on by to check it out. All right, let's get to today's interview. I am so thrilled to be speaking once again to fan favorite Ellen Poulsen, who has been on the show twice before, once for Don't Call Us Malls, a book about the many colorful women of the John Dillinger gang, and again for an interview about her Lucky Luciano book. She's here today to chat about her brand new book called Chasing Dillinger, Police Captain Matt Leach, J. Edgar Hoover, and the Rivalry to Capture Public Enemy Number One. Thank you for coming on again.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for having me.
So I want to mention right off the bat that you had a co-author on this book, Lori Hyde.
Yes, Lori is an A.S. Dillinger researcher. She's an Indiana girl, and she has a great love for the subject. And we agreed, 10 years ago by email that we were both very interested in a character from the Dillinger story named Captain Matt Leach. At that time, there were a lot of mysteries surrounding him and unanswered questions about even his origins, things as simple as that. So we decided by email to collaborate, and it was great having Lori to bounce things off of because she has a good eye for detail and she really knows the story.
I'll bet it's fun to collaborate with someone for a change.
It keeps you on task. I always used to say, oh, I have to show Lori I'm doing something. So it kind of keeps your nose to the grindstone. It's almost like the imaginary friend that you have to answer to. And it made it a lot easier to stick with the subject, knowing that I could just email her with everything.
I'll bet.
And she's a very credible researcher, so I knew I was safe passing the different things I found back to her.
Well, that's wonderful. Despite my deep, deep interest in John Dillinger, I haven't done an episode about him yet. We've talked about him a bit during our interview about the women of the gang, and I've chatted with Paul McAbee a little bit about him, but maybe now we can get deeper into the subject. So what is it about John Dillinger? What makes him such an incredibly compelling figure?
Well, I've had to ask myself that because I was actually asked that question in Chicago. I go with my husband every July to Dillinger Night at the Biograph. It's a place for Dillinger geeks to gather and to hang out, and it's a nice evening. And I was asked that question that night, what makes him so compelling? And I wasn't satisfied with the answer that I gave at that time, and I've had to think about it. So it's almost like I have an answer to give you that's almost rehearsed. At the time, my answer was, during the 1930s, he was a person who offered up excitement for the price of a newspaper. People read newspapers during the Depression, and they were generally about 3 pennies. And you could sit back and you could read all about the exploits of a person who was defying all the rules and apparently beating the odds until it caught up with him. But that answer doesn't explain why Dillinger is still on everybody's minds, including mine. And so to dig a little deeper into who he was, I came up with this answer. I think that because Dillinger came of age in the 1930s, which was an interwar period where America was becoming very isolationist, the people who came over from, quote, the other side, you know, unquote, they didn't want to remember Europe. They didn't want to speak their old languages. Everybody had to kind of toe the line and become an American, and outsiders were very much suspect. So we had garden variety gangsters who all had these ethnic overtones, and Dillinger did not have that. He came across as a heartland type of person from an Indiana farm. So he provided the United States at that time with an anti-hero who in many ways was like, you know, the boy next door or the guy next door, not some suspect from the inner city who really they didn't relate to. So in my opinion, that had something to do with why Dillinger stayed with people for such a long time. And he stayed with people because he was publicized, because newspaper writers also related to that type of a character, and they kept him in people's minds. Then there were crazy things that started to happen with his image in the 40s and 50s and 60s, that his body part was one of his body parts was in the Smithsonian, which is a ridiculous joke to people nowadays. But that had something to do with keeping him going, too, I think. All kidding aside, I really think so.
Yeah, and there has always been this myth that John Dillinger didn't die in Chicago.
That Dillinger did not die at the Biograph is something that has lingered. It's always been a fringe conspiracy theory, and as I'm sure you know, Eric, it's in the media now and in the news that that idea is coming back to haunt us. No pun intended. That maybe it wasn't him who was killed at the Biograph. Maybe it's not his body in the grave. So that's another rather morbid aspect of the story that seems to be keeping Dillinger in the news today.
What's always been so fascinating to me, and I'm sure you and many others, is how someone from such a loving family, a nice kid, could go bad so early on. Could you explain how it happened?
Okay, Eric, the idea of the bad seed is kind of ingrained. I guess the people of a certain generation who all saw that old black and white movie, the idea of a nice family and kids that go wrong, right? Kids that have some kind of a problem and they appear twisted or just bad kids. He began to get into trouble as a teenager, and it went downhill. I mean, he got involved with a man named Edgar Singleton, who was just one of a lot of guys in the neighborhood who led him down the wrong path. He and Edgar Singleton committed a crime. They robbed a local grocer, and the grocer fought back, and Dillinger hit the grocer over the head with some bolts that were wrapped in cloth, and the grocer apparently was strong enough to fight back, and Dillinger had to run and hide for a couple of days. When he was arrested, his family did not come to court with a lawyer. They believed in the power of their faith. They were Quakers, and they didn't think they needed to bring a lawyer. And what happened was Dillinger got hit with a very long prison sentence, and his accomplice walked with 2 years. So he went in. He was also a young married guy. He had just gotten married. So here he was at 19 years old. His life is essentially over. He went into a series of state facilities, the first one being Pendleton Reformatory, and then he graduated over the years to Michigan City, which was the state pen. By the time he got out on parole, he was embittered.
I know he wanted to be a baseball player, right? What do you think he would have done with his life if he hadn't gotten such an unusually harsh sentence? I know it's all speculation, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, he was a baseball player in Mooresville, Indiana, where he lived. In fact, that's where he met his accomplice, Edgar Singleton. He was playing ball in prison, and there's a common misconception that he, upon realizing he was being denied a parole, asked for a transfer to Michigan City because he's claimed to have said they have a real team there. But that's not really true. He was transferred because they found out that he could play baseball. How he perceived it. And he wrote in a letter to his sister that, I guess I was transferred because they want me to play ball, or something, not quoting verbatim, but because they have a team and they want me to play ball, I guess I was transferred. So whether or not playing baseball was Dillinger's real ambition in life, I don't really believe it was. I don't think he had an ambition. It's hard to say what he would have done had he not gotten involved in crime. His personality was such that he was mechanically adept and had some jobs as a machinist. He was not a strong character in prison, and this is my opinion only. My opinion is that he ingratiated himself with the really tough guys in order to be successful in prison, in order not to be beaten half to death or victimized in any way. And his promise to them to rob banks and help fund their escape upon his parole is evidence of his ability to play as a team player and evidence of great loyalty. He was loyal to his friends. He followed through on his promise to rob the banks and fund the escape. So Dillinger had a lot of qualities that would have made him a good employee. But, to say what he would have done, it's kind of hard to figure that out. He wouldn't have become a police officer, you know that.
Right. So who were some of the guys that he met in prison that would make an impression on him? The guys he'd team up with once he got out?
The friends that he made in prison, three started in Pendleton. They were John Hamilton, who was nickname was Red, Homer Van Meter, who was a close friend, somebody who was there for him whenever he needed underworld connections. Homer Van Meter was always around, and he was, his nickname, I believe, was Van. And Harry Pierpont is the kind of the gold standard. He's considered on a lot of levels to have been, not that they had a leader in the first Dillinger gang, but he would have been the leader due to his alpha personality if they had had one. His nickname was Pete. It was also Handsome Harry. I don't know if Handsome Harry was a kind, maybe something made up by a reporter. It sounds like it would have been. But these were the people that he had a real blood brother relationship with. And then there were others. There was Charles Makeley, Russell Clark. These were the people who were part of the Michigan City escape. They are part of what's commonly known as the first Dillinger gang. And, you know, my apologies to people who are real Dillinger people, because this is all something that is, it's like, you know, the Baltimore Catechism in elementary school. I guess harkening back to my Catholic school education, it's just very basic. But this is where he developed his relationship and his ambition to become a career criminal with these men. They're commonly called the first Dillinger gang. They're really not the first gang. When he was paroled, he took up with a series of low-level criminals, and they, in many ways, in their shifting, their shifting presence, because they kept getting arrested, and one would get arrested and rat everybody else out, and they fell like dominoes, the actual first gang. But then you have this gang of guys who got out of Michigan City in the Great Escape, and they went with Dillinger through different cities and towns, from Ohio through Chicago, Wisconsin, all the way out, Kentucky, Tennessee, all the way out to Tucson, Arizona, where they all got busted together. And that was essentially the end of what's called the first Dillinger gang, and also the end of Dillinger's real gang. Because after that, he wasn't with a gang. He had to go to Babyface Nelson's gang. And some people are going to start screaming, no, it was not Babyface Nelson's gang. But he did join the gang that Babyface Nelson had put together after the Tucson arrests and his later escape. So those were the names of the men who he was hanging out with in Michigan City. There were also people who were being paroled from Michigan City. Harry Copeland was one of those. He was paroled. Clifford Moeller was someone. And, you know, to put a spin on the name, Clifford Moeller drank turpentine and faked tuberculosis. I don't know how this happened, but it did. He drank something to simulate tuberculosis symptoms, and he was given a medical release. So it gives you an idea of just how hokey-pokey the prison system was in those days. So in addition to the men who crashed out of Michigan City at the end of September 1933, you have the men who were being paroled from Michigan City who all got together with Dillinger after they were all paroled. It was almost like some sort of class of 1933. And they would get together for different bank robberies. They hung out in East Chicago, Indiana, to procure weapons. There were people there who dealt guns, anything you wanted, anything you needed. So it was at that point that he also got back in the groove with his friend Homer Van Meter, another parolee. And his parole was affected by his having written a letter or having someone write letters saying that he is now ready to resume life as a Sterling citizen. Homer, the bank robber and the train robber and every other kind of robber. And he got paroled that way.
Would you mind summarizing briefly the escape you just mentioned?
Okay. The Michigan City escape is kind of the, I don't know, Moses in the desert for Dillinger readers and Dillinger files. It took place on the last week in September of 1933. It was a fantastic escape where a large group of men were able to take over the shirt factory in one of the buildings, and with a series of maneuvers, they were able to lock up guards and trustees. They actually walked through the administration building, locking up people there, and they escaped from the prison and got into either ran or through stolen cars, were able to make it out of Indiana. And they made it out of Indiana with several detours. One car went into Indianapolis to meet with the girlfriend of Harry Pierpont. Remember, I mentioned Handsome Harry before. He had a girlfriend named Mary Kinder who was hoping that her brother was going to be able to get in on the escape, but her brother did have tuberculosis. It was something that people had in those days, and he was put into the prison infirmary. So she was pretty upset that she put herself on the line and her brother did not get out. Another car made it out and went through Bean Blossom, a small town in Indiana. There, one of the escapees was either thrown or pushed from the car, and James Jenkins, and he was shot and killed by a posse. Another one was actually roaming around with a sheriff that they had taken hostage, a man named Sheriff Neal. They took him hostage, and one of these escapees wandered around with this sheriff for a day or two. And they ended up giving themselves up and bringing in Captain Matt Leach, the subject of the book that I wrote. Captain Matt Leach made the sheriff a suspect for a short time. Captain Matt Leach came into this situation very understaffed. I don't want to say clueless because that is insulting. He had no cars, no radio. He was the captain of the Indiana State Police, and the biggest problem that they were anticipating that year was a lot of traffic to the 1933 World's Fair in Chicago. So they were completely taken by surprise. And, whether or not the Michigan City escape was an inside job is something that's up for a lot of debate. There is some evidence to suggest that there was payoffs and people on the inside who knew about it and who were going to open a couple of doors for them. That was never totally established, but there were investigations into this shocking escape. And they never really came up with anything solid, but Harry Pierpont, Handsome Harry, He said to his dying day that he knew the secrets of Michigan City and that he was going to take them to his grave. Now, it definitely was a little bit more going on than just nine convicts in the right place at the right time. There was more to it than that. And Harry Pierpont had connections in Kokomo, Indiana, and one of the connections liked to pose as a businessman, and he went into the prison and had an interview with an assistant warden and wrote some letters and said, you know, the way is clear now, stuff like that. I mean, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to look at it and say something was going on.
Sure. And just so my listeners understand the timeline here, we talked first about Dillinger's initial stint in jail, his parole, then his membership in some of these low-level gangs, including the White Cap Gang, if I remember right. And then he is involved in breaking his friends out of prison, right?
That's right. The term, the White Cap Gang, is kind of a loose phrase. Nobody really knows where that phrase comes from. You know, you tend to think they were running around wearing white caps, but it came maybe even from something very obscure and was picked up. But those guys were the first ones to rob banks with Dillinger. The White Cap is very underreported and undercovered guys, in my opinion. You know, for every 100 people who have sort of a cult thing going for Handsome Harry Pierpont, you don't find too many people interested in the shellac-drinking Clifford Muller or Lefty Parker. Or they were all people who knew Dillinger pretty well.
There's a Harry Pierpont cult?
Well, I say that loosely. I just think that some of these very well-known members of the Dillinger gang have a bit of a following. People who are very interested in them, sure. I'm part of the cults.
So this is a perfect segue to one of the main figures in your book, Matt Leach. As these events with Dillinger are happening in 1933, Matt Leach is making his presence known with the Indiana State Police. Would you mind giving us a brief background on Leach and how he got into law enforcement? It's such an interesting story.
Well, Captain Matt Leach started as a young immigrant named Matija Likanen, and he catapulted himself in his lifetime to the person who would become known as Dillinger's nemesis. He was the police captain that Dillinger liked to call, liked to send postcards to, and he's in many ways the antithesis of Dillinger. And the way he started was he was a very driven and hardworking young immigrant and came over with his brothers. And they were macho men, the Likanen brothers. You know, they were very tall and very strong. And one brother became a boxer, and Matt Leach managed his career. Now, the family name was changed from Likanen to Leach again. It was a time when people weren't hanging on to the European identity so much. Everybody was under some pressure to be Americanized. So they changed the name to Leach, and he took Matt for his name, never Matthew. He was always Matt. And he became a Gary police officer around 1920, Gary, Indiana, which was at the time an outback for Chicago crime. Gary, Indiana was the center of prostitution, gambling, bootlegging. It was along with East Chicago and Hammond, kind of like actually had ties to Chicago mobsters. So he probably in Gary got to know a lot of the characters that he might later see or hear about in Chicago. He rose through the rank and file to lieutenant. He was an ambitious man. He put his brother, the boxer, in the papers. He became a press agent early on for his brother. And so when he was actually asked to speak on Dillinger to the media, he had a lot of experience already because he had been very friendly with the media in the late 20s, early 30s. He was, in the manner of politics, he was fired from his job on the Gary Police Department. But being fired wasn't necessarily a merit-based issue. He had been accused of some sort of bribery or bootlegging thing at the time that he was fired, but that was pretty common among the police in those days. He was fired for political reasons. They would fire 14 cops and hire 14 more. Same thing happened in the prisons. And to get back to Michigan City for a moment, the month before that, the Great Escape, all of the prison guards had been fired and replaced by green guards, they were called, with no experience, simply for political reasons. When the party turned over, when the Republicans went out and the Democrats came in, everybody lost their job. It was just something that was going on in Indiana at that time. So back to Leach and Gary Police Department. When he was fired from the Gary Police Department, he fooled around with a few jobs. He worked in a furniture plant. He worked in a steel plant. Leach couldn't be kept to a desk. He couldn't be kept to an assembly line. He had a hyperactive personality and a tremendous amount of ambition, and he wasn't going to be held down. So he started to get involved with politics. He had also been a soldier. He was in the National Guard. He fought in World War I. He fought in the Mexican conflict and was a staunch supporter of the American Legion. In the American Legion, he got to know a man named Paul Voorhees McNutt, who was the future governor of Indiana. And Leach campaigned vigorously for Paul McNutt. When McNutt was elected governor in 1933, Leach was brought on in a very menial position known as a gatekeeper. I've tried to find out what that was. You know, that's a job description that I can't really figure out what a gatekeeper was, but that's what he was. That's how he started, a gatekeeper for the Indiana legislature.
Oh, interesting. Typically, a gatekeeper is someone who protects a gate. not necessarily a literal gate, but a gateway to McNutt, perhaps. Maybe he was responsible for screening people who wanted an audience with McNutt.
That makes sense, more than anything else. So from his gatekeeper position, he just started to move up the rank and file and make friends. He made friends with Al Feeney. Now, Al Feeney, and these are real obscure names to people today, and I won't bore everybody with a big, long thing on who was Al Feeney, but he was putting together the first safety division, reorganizing and reworking the Indiana State Police. And so he brought Matt Leach on as the first captain of the newly organized Indiana State Police. They were never called, they were state troopers, but in those days they didn't call themselves state troopers. That came later.
This was a real eye-opener, right? A good example of the patronage system. He stepped into a position above other candidates who had worked for the state police for years and far more experienced than him.
That's a good point. The patronage system never looked for qualifications. It was all about, what have you done for me lately? And that would go against him later, but as it did all of them. But yes, he was an unpopular from the get-go, as they say, because of the fact that other people were probably vying for the position, And he was especially disliked by the group in Crown Point, Indiana, who would later be in charge of the body, the body and soul of John Dillinger after he was arrested in Tucson, Arizona. The very people who hated Matt Leach from the beginning would then have Leach's prey, John Dillinger, and they would push Leach out. Leach wouldn't be able to get anywhere near him. So it worked against him ultimately, but he tried. He tried to do the best job he could. As the captain of the Indiana State Police, he had to be kind of the equivalent of a police benevolent league president. Like, I live in New York, so we have the PBA, we have the commissioner who makes all the statements to the press. He had to be all of those people. He had to be the commissioner who made every statement and qualified every move on the part of the governor. He had to manage a police force that had no radios in the cars. They were understaffed. They were under armed. They did not have the ammunition that the bad guys had. And he just had too much on his plate, to use a cliche. And it would have been okay if the biggest problem they were facing was actually what they thought would be the biggest problem, the traffic going from Indiana into Chicago for the World's Fair. But, they were pretty blind to what was going on. There was another huge prison break on Memorial Day that spring that had sprung 10 big convicts. Wilbur Underhill, the tri-state killer, Harvey Bailey, heavy hitters in the 1930s Midwest crime wave. There was the kidnapping of Charles Urschel by the Machine Gun Kelly gang. Stuff was going on all over the place. Why they had these blinders on and why they didn't believe it was going to happen in Indiana is really up for conjecture. But when it did hit the fan, if I can be so vulgar, Leach had a lot that he had to deal with, and he dealt with it initially. He got away with it. The press still liked him. He was able to give grand patronizing statements and use a lot of platitudes like, "We're going to get him," and that worked for a while. But not for too long.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So Dillinger's rise and fall was pretty meteoric. It all happened in about a year, right? Not his criminal career as a whole, of course, but as someone famous, being followed by millions. How did he move from relative obscurity to becoming someone written about in newspapers every day? How did that happen?
Well, they say that with the time frame that you mentioned, they call it 13-month crime spree. Maybe it was 14 months from May until his death in the following July. But, I give Matt Leach the credit for Dillinger's initial ascendancy, because he became somewhat fixated on him. I don't want to say obsessed, because I'm not a psychiatrist, but he was fixated enough on Dillinger, and he made sure that Dillinger's name was in the newspapers all the time. And he focused on Dillinger when there really was no real reason to do that, because there were other members of the gangs that Dillinger was running around with. At the time, he also leaned very heavily on the research and the detective work of one Pinkerton detective named Forrest Huntington. And Mr. Huntington laid a lot of the groundwork for who Dillinger was and gave it to Matt Leach. And what happened was Matt Leach was taking too much information to the media, and Forrest Huntington was getting really upset because a lot of this was confidential, names of informants, whatever type of police work he was doing. As a Pinkerton detective, he liked to keep it close to the vest. And with Leach telling every bit of intelligence to the newspapers, Forrest Huntington washed his hands eventually of Matt Leach. And a lot of police officers in Indiana started to feel the same way. They didn't buy into the idea of, you know, telling it from the mountain, you know, go tell it on the mountain. They did not want it done that way. But that was what catapulted Dillinger initially into becoming such a well-known character. And by the time he was arrested in Tucson, that was from the Michigan City escape happened in September. There were a couple of rather startling bank robberies which garnered a lot of newspaper publicity. And these were bank robberies where hostages were loaded onto running boards. Those old cars had these like running boards that you could stand on around the doors. And this kind of cartoon atmosphere surrounding these bank robberies is what got these bank robberies into the newspapers. This was happening all over the Midwest at the time, and there is no real reason why Dillinger would have gotten so much attention just on his own during the months of October, November, December, and January, when there were other members of the gang, possibly more charismatic, who had more colorful criminal backgrounds. It was a matter of Matt Leach had a kind of fixation with Dillinger. Part of the fixation was also Dillinger's proximity to Leach. Leach thought he could catch him, you see. He thought he could catch Dillinger, and he thought that this would give him a big collar, a big name in the papers, because his intelligence told him that Dillinger was in Indiana, Chicago, places where Leach was able to go. And Gary in East Chicago, Indiana, where Dillinger actually did have an apartment. So Leach felt, okay, it looks good. It looks like I can catch him. So let me put his name out there. Let me put my name out there. And when he is caught, it's going to look good for me. But excuse me, please, I don't want to make Captain Matt Leach sound like an egomaniac. That's doing him a disservice. He wanted the glory for Governor McNutt. He wanted the glory for the administration that had given him this great job. And he wanted to give them the good payback. It started to go bad for him when he missed Dillinger by minutes in Gary. He missed him by minutes in East Chicago. And at that point, it became like, all right, Dillinger is this jackrabbit, this guy that Leach can't catch. And that's when it started to go south for Leach. And that's when Dillinger started to look really good because he was the jackrabbit. Nobody could catch him.
And Dillinger fed off this rivalry, right? He enjoyed it, it seemed. How did he feel about Leach?
The Dillinger gang hated Matt Leach. Dillinger did feel the rivalry, and he did send him a series of postcards. Nothing obscene, nothing, I'm going to kill you, nothing like that. Hey, Cap, Hey, Capt, C-A-P-T, missed you. You know, missed you. I was watching you. You didn't see me. Ha ha. Crazy stuff like that. But the gang itself, they hated Matt Leach. It became very personal because at one point, Harry Pierpont, the member of the gang who was the handsome Harry, the trigger man, the charismatic member of the gang, and also the toughest, the most ruthless, his mother was arrested. His mother was arrested in Terre Haute, Indiana, and his brother was arrested. But Harry Pierpont was a mama's boy, so you don't mess with that. You know, if anybody's ever seen that movie White Heat, where James Cagney is just totally obsessed with his mother and vice versa, this was the type of relationship that Pierpont had with his mother, Lena Pierpont. So when she was arrested in Terre Haute, Pierpont put two and two together and decided that Leach was behind the arrest. Now, this was something that Matt Leach denied. But whether or not he was behind it, we really, most people believe he was. So he hated Leach. The Malls hated him. Pearl Elliott in Kokomo, who was laundering the money that Dillinger was getting through the bank robberies, the money that would fund the escape, she vowed to kill him, Matt Leach. Mary Kinda, Harry Pierpont's Mall, her house was being raided by Matt Leach. You know, they didn't worry about due process too much in those days, and there were no warrants, but they would just bang on the door to her Indianapolis house, her family home where her mother lived and her sister, and they would just rifle through the house and grab whatever they wanted to. So Leach was a despised character, and Dillinger had him on his, he had like this kind of de facto list of people he was going to kill. But he wasn't a hitman. Dillinger wasn't a hitman. He wasn't the type to, he wasn't a contract killer. He just had his, you know what kind of list that is. You know what we call that list, right? He had that list. And Matt Leach was on it. And Harry Pierpont allegedly did try to shoot Leach. He had a chance at one point. It's a myth or a wild story that he had a chance to shoot him on an Indianapolis street, and Mary Kinta talked him out of it. So there was no love lost between him. It was almost as though the gang was putting all of their fears and anxieties and antisocial tendencies on the head of this one police officer.
Did Leach bother Dillinger's family members at all in an attempt to twist the screws into Dillinger?
Well, he was one to go to Mooresville, Indiana, and he was seen there, and yes, he did. He did try to bother them, and his interest in Mooresville kind of took a strange turn, though. When the FBI got involved in the Dillinger story a couple of months down the road, and it looked very apparent that everybody was pushing Leach out, he hung around Mooresville in order to see how much surveillance the FBI was doing in Mooresville. And he made a lot of complaints to the Indiana Police Board that the FBI agents were endangering his men because there were too many law enforcement agents in Mooresville. He was complaining that he kind of wanted it for himself, and he wasn't going to get it that way anymore. So, Leach was a person who had his favorites. Like, he always went after members of the Dillinger family, the Mary Kinda's family, you know, Pierpont's mall, Pierpont's family. People who were close by, in close proximity, people who lived or were around Indiana. Interestingly enough, He stayed away from others, like the family of John Hamilton, which was up in Stall Ste. Marie in near Michigan. He never got involved with them. He never got involved with Homer Van Meter or Babyface Nelson. It's almost as though he just had the people that he wanted to focus on and everybody else just stayed in the peripheral. It was a little odd.
Wild. So how did Dillinger ultimately separate from Harry Pierpont?
Well, they were, as I said, the blood brothers of two penitentiaries, and then Dillinger got Pierpont out by robbing banks and stockpiling the money to pay for the escape. They were separated in Tucson, Arizona, when they were arrested there. That was the pivotal point for the first Dillinger Gang, or what was commonly known in the newspapers at that time as the Terror Gang. That was the arrest of Charlie Makeley, Russell Clark, Dillinger, and Harry Pierpont. They were arrested. It was fantastic newspaper coverage of that arrest. And the Mulls were arrested. Dillinger's girl, Evelyn, I say girl. Can you still say that? Is that politically incorrect? Dillinger's lady, Evelyn. I don't know. I can't say it. Dillinger's girl. Dillinger's woman friend, Evelyn Frechette. Pierpont's Moll, Mary Kinder. And Russell Clark's mall's name was Opal Long. They were all arrested too. And arrested peacefully by Tucson traffic cops. So it was a fantastic series of events as they were picked up one by one. And the newspaper coverage was incredible. And every aspect of the story was covered in the Tucson newspapers. But at that point, Dillinger never saw Pierpont again because Dillinger was sent to Indiana to stand trial for the murder of William Patrick O'Malley, who was a police officer killed in a robbery. And Pierpont, with Clark and Makeley, was going to Ohio to stand trial for capital murder in the murder of a sheriff in Lima, Ohio. And Ohio people, don't skin me if I said Lima. I don't know if it's Lima or Lima. I mean, I always say Lima, Ohio, but I thought I would try Lima for this. So, you know, they went to Ohio, and it was very prophetic because the statement, you know, Dillinger goes to Indiana and the rest go to Ohio meant that all were going to the states that had the electric chair and all were going on trial for first degree murder. So it was a death sentence for all of them.
I did not review our earlier interview about Dillinger's women. So if some of this is a bit repetitive from those episodes, my apologies. I can't remember if we talked about the Crown Point escape. I think we did. I know I could keep you here for hours, I'm sure. With your knowledge on the subject, we have to be a little selective on what we cover here. But I really want to ask you about Leach's involvement in the events as before, after, and including his escape from the Crown Point jail. Would you mind summarizing for us that escape? It's such a pivotal moment in the Dillinger saga.
Oh, the escape from Crown Point, it's almost become something that you see every day now since this whole business of exhuming Dillinger's body, the pros and cons. It seems like every news abstract compresses it into the big event, which was the escape with the wooden gun. And it's almost become cliche at this point even to talk about it, right? But it needs to be addressed because it was an important moment in the life and times of Dillinger. He was sent to Crown Point County, and I will try to keep it in league with what we're talking about, which is Matt Leach, Captain Matt Leach. Captain Matt Leach fought the good fight in Tucson, Arizona for jurisdiction of John Dillinger. And he was defeated by a faction from Crown Point, Indiana. These were coincidentally the men who hated him when he became the first captain of the Indiana State Police, because they were a different faction. They wanted their own people in there. So now it was really payback time, right? Leach went in there. He wanted Dillinger brought back to Michigan City. And Crown Point won jurisdiction over John Dillinger through, we don't know for sure, but it's generally assumed that there was a little bit of machinations going on behind the scenes in Lake County, which is, I guess you can use the phrase Lake County and Crown Point synonymously. They both mean the same thing as we talk about the wooden gun escape. When Dillinger was brought to Crown Point, there was just no security. It's everybody knows the pictures of the prosecutor, Robert Estill, with his arm around Dillinger. That picture was taken after they had all had some beer. Sheriff Lillian Holly, the woman who was the sheriff, and she was pretty much her reputation was destroyed because of it. She had a keg of beer out there, and the reporters and Captain John Stage from Chicago and big Captain Reynolds, big Dillinger people, the most important people in the hunt were all there. And it must have been a real carnival atmosphere, drinking beer. The news reels are there. Everyone's taking pictures of this charismatic guy. And if you look at these pictures and compare them to how people are treated today when they're under arrest, he wasn't shackled. He wasn't handcuffed. He was wearing his own clothes. He had a sharp pen protruding out of his pocket. A sharp pencil protruding from his vest pocket. What kind of security was there? And everybody was feeling very confident. There were armed civilians patrolling outside. That possibly was the reason for the overconfidence. So he went into Crown Point County Jail with a lot of ceremony. At that point, his attorney, he switched from local, he had used a series of lawyers without much gravitas. He switched over to an attorney named Louis Piquette, who was a Chicago character who was really up to the task of representing Dillinger up in the media and everything else. He was somebody who could have been in a Warner Brothers movie, Piquette. Piquette brought in a series of visitors. One was an alibi witness named Maya Bogue. He brought in Dillinger's mall, Evelyn Frechette, to visit. It was a pretty open city there. So, March 3rd, 1934, Dillinger escaped. He escaped by producing a wooden gun. The origins of this gun, there was the assistant to his new underworld attorney, Louis Piquette, had the gun made by a carpenter, and somehow the gun was brought into the prison. Some people may still think that he carved it out of soap or whittled it. That's kind of a popular thing from the Woody Allen movie, Take the Money and Run, but snuck in or brought into him. And so he started with the wooden gun. He jabbed somebody, Ernest Blanc, a couple of people like that, a trustee, an assistant warden. He got them all into a prison cell, locked them up, went through the building, went through the kitchen, found some Thompson submachine guns that just happened to be sitting out. Whether they were a plant, it's possible. He took the Thompson submachine guns. He went out through the back door, walked a few steps into the garage, and took a car that was, it's commonly been called the sheriff's car. Now, honestly, that was just another way to get at Lillian Holly, the woman sheriff, and make her look like a laughingstock. It wasn't necessarily the sheriff's car. They were called county cars, and they were cars that were used by law enforcement. And somehow in the circus that, you know, took place after his escape, and everybody wanted to blame it on the woman sheriff, quote unquote, that was part of it. Oh, he stole her car. What a dupe she was, you know. So that was the Crown Point escape, and he was able to get himself into Chicago in the company of an African-American escapee named Herbert Youngblood, and they parted ways, and he went into Chicago, and he found his way to the home, the rented apartment of his girlfriend's sister, where he kind of hung out with her on Halsted Street in Chicago, and he took his girlfriend, Evelyn Frechette, moved the stolen car to some block in Chicago and abandoned it there on the north side. So Matt Leach was one of the first people, Captain Matt Leach was one of the first people to say, how could this have happened? I wanted him in the state pen, in the solitary confinement in the state pen. Why wasn't he there? How did this happen? But at that point, the walls were closing in on Leach. He was being pushed out by the very factions at Crown Point who had sheltered Dillinger, who had posed with Dillinger, who had made sure that Dillinger was taken out of Tucson and put in a minimum security county jail. But they had the upper hand at that point, and they conspired to keep Matt Leach away from everything. So Leach wasn't even really able to get his opinion out there. At that point, he had fallen so out of favor that even his own bosses, the Indiana Police Board and Al Feeney and even the governor, were telling Leach, listen, you gotta knock it off. No more statements. No more statements to the press. So as much as Leach knew what happened at Crown Point was really wrong and contributed to that escape, he had no venue for promoting his ideas at that point.
Well, this wraps up part one of John Dillinger versus Matt Leach, part two on its way. In it, we talk about J. Edgar Hoover and his rivalry with Matt Leach. We talk about some of the peripheral law enforcement figures who attempt to hunt and capture John Dillinger. And Ellen offers her opinion on the recent exhumation attempts of John Dillinger's corpse. And again, my guest has been Ellen Polson, who is author, along with Lori Hyde, of Chasing Dillinger, Police Captain Matt Leach, J. Edgar Hoover, and the Rivalry to Capture Public Enemy Number One. Until next time, this has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.